That's Nightclubbin', and welcome back. Grace Jones, who was born on this day in 1948. Once again, welcome everybody. This is Mark Steiner, and this is May the 19th. And I'll tell a story that some people might think is a bit off color, but it's not. But this is a very important day. Lots happened on history in this day, as you've just heard from our last broadcast. And we used to call this, get ready now, Malcolm Ho Day. What? What? What do you mean? Well, let me explain what that means. Back in 1966, we had a group that created this, called the Revolutionary Arts Cooperative, and made these T-shirts. And on the front it said Malcolm Ho Day, May 19th. On the back it had a picture of Malcolm X and Ho Chi Minh, mm-hmm. who shares a birthday today. Yeah. And it was, to us, a revolutionary moment, a radical moment, talking about the birthdays of the president of the Republic of Vietnam, who led the fight against the Americans and the revolution in China, was a great poet as well, and a writer, and, of course, Malcolm X, born on this May 19th. So we're going to convene a panel to talk about the legacy of that and more that happened on this day that kind of fits into that, Lorraine Hansberry's birthday and more on this day, and many things happened to kind of correspond and come in. Major passages by Blanche K. Bruce, another figure in our history. So we have gathered this panel. Dr. Carsonia Wise Whitehead is with you. Kay Whitehead is with us. Good morning. Good to see you. Assistant Professor of Communications of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University. Author of the new book, Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, just came out, and we'll be having her on soon to talk about that.
Excellent.
Good to have you here. My dear friend, Dr. Ray Wimbush is with us, joins by phone, director of the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University. Ray, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, how you doing, man?
Very good. And Dr. Kimberly Moffitt's with us. She's assistant professor of American Studies at UMBC and author of Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities. Welcome to the show
once again.
So good to have you all with us here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's talk about the significance of what this day means. I mean, when you think of the legacy of Malcolm X, and we've been through all of the machinations and arguments between Manning Marable's book and Ray, you on the show to counter that, and the people have argued that. But when we look at the legacy of a revolutionary leader like Malcolm X, and also on this day, let me throw this in on this day as well. This was also the day that the New York Post Sunday Magazine in 1963 published, as I said earlier in a day in history, King's letter from the Birmingham jail.
Yes.
There's just a lot of things that come together. So, and I don't like to just look to history, Ray Wimbush, as just something to look back on, but to think about where it takes us.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially with regard to Malcolm. I think that what we've done, Mark, you know, we boiled Dr. King's legacy down to four words, I have a dream, and unfortunately we've boiled Malcolm down to four words also by any means necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And both of these men were far, far more than that. And to me, they're very important in terms of what they said and did, particularly Malcolm, and his relevance for today.
So what do we all think is that relevance today, Kay? What is that relevance for today?
Well, it's interesting because in preparation for the show, I spoke to seventh graders. And I asked them, I said, out of these four names, tell me who you know the most about. And I said, Dr. King, Barack Obama, Malcolm X, and I said, Jesus Christ. Barack Obama will be happy to know that he came out on the top of the list. I said, well,
really?
Which one don't you know anything about? And they said, who was the guy with the X? Who is that?
Mm. Where was this? Where did this take place?
This happened this morning. I went to my son's school.
In a public school in Baltimore, Maryland.
It's an independent school.
In a what?
An independent school.
An independent school.
So, didn't know anything about Malcolm X. So, it was interesting to think about his legacy and think about whether or not we are teaching him forward. I know that Dr. King is part of the big six that we always talk about when we talk about Black history. Malcolm X is not always a part of the conversation. I even came to Malcolm X late. My father was involved in the Civil Rights Movement, but we talked about King. We had the picture of King, Kennedy, and Jesus Christ on the wall.
Right.
We never talked about Malcolm X. I didn't learn about Malcolm X until I went to college. And I said, well, there was another leader at the same time who was just as influential from a different community than Dr. King. And I'm concerned that young people today are not even learning by any means necessary. I mean, they're learning the I Have a Dream, and they're learning a lot about other figures in African-American history, but that Malcolm X, I don't believe, is still getting his proper due.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that has to do with him not fitting the paradigm of what we consider to be acceptable activism, right? Mm-hmm. That he, at that point in time, even in the midst of a very radical period in our country's history, was seen as an extremist by many, even though there were several who embraced what he was talking about and believed that his vision made sense for Black America in particular, but he was still very much seen as the extreme, especially when you have him countering or bookending with Martin Luther King. And so if you've got him on one end, then Malcolm has to be the polar opposite, because that's where we find ourselves in terms of lexicon often, is having to pigeonhole people into particular spots. And there can only be one acceptable Black civil rights activist at a time, right? So we then create another space for someone like a Malcolm X, who then has to be seen as that extreme figure that we make reference to. And to the point where even in history, we have watered him down so that he doesn't play the same significant role in the history books for many of our young.
I wonder how connected it is to religion. I know that with Dr. King coming out of the Baptist church, for a number of African Americans, it was acceptable. I mean, the church was a place where activism happened. You went there for prayer meetings. You went there to celebrate. You went there to cry and to console one another. If you were within the Black Baptist tradition, Malcolm X was on the outside of that as well. So not just in terms of not being acceptable in terms of activism, it's also this thing around religion and how that played such an important part and still does.
Yeah, I agree
in the
with
African-American
you.
Community.
Absolutely.
I guess that,
you know, but
go ahead, Ray.
I think one of the things that's important, though, is that, you know, the divide between Malcolm and Martin was more created by media than anything else.
Yes.
You know, I always liked the fact that Malcolm was very strategic and understanding. In fact, in my opinion, he was more strategic and understanding how the media worked than Dr. King was. Dr. King, both of them, to be sure, use the media, but Malcolm's strategy, there's a quotation, and most people know that, right, if had Malcolm lived, he had planned on joining Dr. King in the famous march in Selma, March, and he told Dr. King, he actually said to him that what I'm going to do is really criticize you publicly. I'm misquoting him, but the idea is there. I'm going to criticize you publicly so that you'll become more acceptable to white America than I would. Because white America at that time thought that both of those people were at an extreme. And, of course, they thought that Malcolm was at he was further from what they thought a good Negro ought to be. And so Malcolm actually encouraged people to accept Dr. King. And I think that was a very strategic way of him. You know, I just admire his strategy. Always have.
Let me talk about the historical context for a moment and then talk about where that leaves us right now in today's world. I mean, when I made the kind of semi-joke at the top of our conversation, this was a time of revolutionary ferment across the globe and in this country. And Malcolm X represented that, and so did King, and so did many other people. So did Stokely Carmichael, who was another part of that pantheon of people who we think of him only as... as Black Power, you know, but we don't see him in the depth of what he really meant by that, or understand that he was the one who also came up with one of the most famous slogans of the 1960s, which was anti-war. Mm-hmm. Well, he's the one who came up with "Hell no, we won't go."
Yep.
That was Stokely Carmichael, right?
That's right.
So,
yes, it was.
So there was a movement going on, and there were connections. So, and we're in a world now where there are a lot of movements going on, but there's no kind of one, there's not a feeling of a central force like there was at that time, right? So that's why I think that people have a hard time kind of wrestling with what that meant and understanding what that revolutionary force meant. How relevant is that for now?
Well, one thing I think, even some of the revolutionary forces out now, is the idea of central leadership, which was key in the 60s to getting a lot of things done, you know, most exemplified with the three people you just named, right now is actually being rejected by some of the groups that claim that they're being revolutionary. The one that, you know, comes to mind immediately, of course, is the Occupy movement. And I had said, Mark, it was kind of unpopular when I said it a couple of years ago, that without a central leader in this nation, maybe not other nations, but in this nation, the movement was going to dissipate, and I think much of the Occupy movement has dissipated because of that. I think in the world today, I think leadership, there's so many ideas that are percolating, you know, out there, but we don't coalesce around a central figure. And I think the need of a central figure, Mandela in South Africa during the 60s and 70s and even 80s and 90s, the ones we mentioned here in the United States, and even going back to the 20s with Marcus Garvey in the United States, I think that this, the way it works now is that you don't do that. I mean, arguably, it's funny, every time I turn into Al Sharpton's show in the afternoon, he says, America's civil rights leader. And I kind of always get a little, yeah, the reaction that you have, because I get a little snarky with that. Because now, had you said that back in the 60s and said, Martin Luther King, America's civil, oh, yeah, that sounds right, and it's demonstrable. But now nobody believes that, you know, Al, we know he has an MSNBC show, but nobody really believes that, and right. I think that's the problem.
I wonder, too, if it's something about the number of voices that we have speaking. In teaching communication, and I have my students take a look at the civil rights movement, and we talk about the ways that the message went forth. You did not have Twitter. You did not have Facebook. You did not have blogs, but yet the message went forward, coming out of the Black church, coming out of community centers. There seems to be a central message that people carry forth. Today, when you get online and when I have students do research, there is a cacophony of voices. So they're trying to figure out what is the issue we should focus on? What should we be doing? Who should we be listening to? At that time, you had a clear enemy. When you think about Jim Crow and you think about fighting for your rights, you had some very clear enemies and some clear barriers. Now there are a number of issues. Is it about what's happening in the community? Is it about what's happening in the economy? Is it about health care? Is it about literacy rates? I mean, there's so many issues that you're trying to focus on that I think it's very difficult to get people to kind of come together around one central thing. Although it does happen at points, it seems like we flare up. And something's very important, and very, very quickly it dissipates. And then the next issue flares up. Mm-hmm. It seems to be issue after issue, almost like a wave that keeps hitting us, because every time we step back and think, oh, let's tackle what's happening in the schools, then we think about, you know what, but this healthcare thing needs, that's important as well. And what about the fact that they don't have shoes to wear? Like, it seems to be too many issues. And I'm not complaining about that. It's the time that we live in. But I wonder if that's one of the reasons why we have a difficult time focusing on one central leader anymore.
And I would say yes. And I think the piece that we forget about where we are now versus then is that integration has played a large part in why there is such this diversity of perspectives, right? Because we're now having other experiences. We now have access to other aspects of society that we didn't before. And so now being so integrated, and I am even on radio using the parenthetical expression of integration, that we are at a space now where, in fact, we don't necessarily share that same consolidated voice or that same central argument of who that enemy is, because there are so many perspectives being offered and so many issues that we believe are significant. But as much as I agree with that point, I also am in a space where I'm appreciative of the number of voices that we are hearing. Mm-hmm. And knowing, again, dispelling this whole idea of the Black community being this monolithic society that we all take on the same issues and believe the same things and we all carry out life in the same way. But in fact, we're in a space now because of the way media is so accessible to us that we get to hear what the issues are for different segments of this very broad definition of a Black community.
Right, but you know, another thing, very quickly, I think, is that we have weaker voices today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that all of them are weak,
mm-hmm.
but like, I've been very intrigued by the fact that 3 weeks ago, an owner of the NBA, in a
yes.
private conversation, to be sure, made a statement, and as a result of this statement, we know that it was racist, and then there was like this rah-rah-rah when the commissioner of the NBA said, we're going to fine them $2.5 million, get rid of them out of the league, and everybody applauded. And I always say that Black people declare victory way too quick.
Well, yes.
Three weeks later, nothing has happened.
That's right.
Literally,
that's right.
nothing has
that's
happened.
Right.
if this had been, see, when you listen to a Malcolm X speak, or Mark, as you said earlier, if you even could get a translation of Ho Chi Minh at the time, or Mandela's voice coming out of prison, or whatever, it was very clear what was being said. I can imagine, had this occurred, I'm talking about the NBA thing, mm-hmm. 40 years ago, there would have been a strike by the black players.
Easily.
And, you know, mm-hmm. as there were, you know, in the 68 Olympics when Tommy Smith mm-hmm. and John Carlos held up their fist at the 68
right.
Olympics.
Right.
I think that right now we have weaker voices. They're mediated by, well, should I say this? Because Malcolm didn't mediate his voice. And to a degree, neither did Dr. King. But now everybody said, well, we'll just test right on Gallup, or will I get a Twitter feed, you know, that will diss me or something like that. Everybody is so, you know, kind of careful about what they're saying now. And I think that's a qualitative difference in leadership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would agree. And I still, but going back to what Dr. Winbush is saying, I think that's very much tied to integration. Because,
yeah.
again, that access that we now have to these different spaces that we didn't before. So now you have black players on the in the NBA with multi-million dollar contracts
yeah.
who are now, because of integration, reflecting on whether or not I should take a stand and say something.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
they recognize that there is a huge backlash to what is said, because we're in such a media saturated society, that whatever it is that is said could end up being the end of a career, or the end of, you know, those several endorsements that they get each year. And so they're very careful about it in ways that I don't think would have happened during the civil rights movement.
I think that that issue also led into a bigger discussion around privacy, because I thought about it from a communication perspective. What does it mean to have your private conversations be taped and put
yeah.
out there?
Yeah.
I mean, I had my sons kind of go through the house and write down everything they heard mommy and daddy say that might have been kind of questionable if it got out into the bigger, broader spectrum. So I understand that 40 years ago, we definitely would have had a huge strike. But I'm thinking there are other issues that I talked about earlier that we're dealing with that we didn't deal with now.
Absolutely.
You are taping my private conversations. I put something out on Twitter. I get angry at a store. I put something out. And all of a sudden, everybody's angry with me.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the Twitter feed or the Facebook. I think now we do have a rush to put things out, and we have seen what has happened as a result of that. And maybe that's also a reason why people are a little bit more cautious now, because am I sure this is what I really want to say, and what are going to be the long-term implications of that?
We're about to take a brief break, as we are here with Dr. Kay Whitehead, Dr. Ray Winbush, and Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, as we explore the life and legacy of Malcolm X and what it means for this 21st century. Stay with us. More to come. On our way to break, we're hearing Celia Cruz, the great Cuban singer, singing Guantanamera. Guantanamera was written by the revolutionary Cuban poet and leader José Martí, who was killed by Spanish troops on this day in the Battle of Dos Ríos in 1895. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner.
Dijo Martí, ¿de dónde crece la palma? Y antes de morir. We'll be right back.
That's Coleman Hawkins playing I'm Beginning to See the Light. He died on this day in 1969, the great Coleman Hawkins. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner as we explore the life and legacy of Malcolm X and what it means for the world we live in today, this 21st century. We are here with Dr. Kay Whitehead, Assistant Professor of Communication and African and African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland. She's the author of the new book, Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, which we will be talking to her about very soon. Dr. Ray Winbush, Director of the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University, and Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Assistant Professor of American Studies at UMBC and author of the book Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair Body Politics in Africana Communities. I wonder if on some levels the difference between then and now is that despite the fact that when you were living in the 50s or 60s, you were in a world where segregation was just being ended, mm-hmm. when King had led a movement where racial terror was being stopped in the South. I mean, literally, that's the biggest thing to me that King did, people don't talk about very much, is that he ended the reign of racial terror mm-hmm. in the South, of physical terror, and Malcolm galvanizing forces in the North. Mm-hmm. And even though the oppression felt deep, there was a sense that you had power to change it. There was a sense you had power to stand up to it. And now with the dissipation in this world today, it's almost like, you know, that and that what happened was that the corporations, and you see all the memos that have come out from people like Justice Powell, who wrote all these memos in the early 70s before it became Supreme Court Justice, saying to corporate leaders, we have to take back because we're losing the power of America. Yes. And they spent this 40 years taking back. That people don't have the sense of power anymore, that we can actually stand up and make it. And stop them. I mean, I think that's part of what Malcolm had, that Martin had, that Stokely had, that Ella Baker had, that many other people had, that writers like Lorraine Hansberry had, that Asada Shakur had, that James Baldwin had in his works and readings, that people had, that we are not losing now. I mean, you had, in the white world as well, you had the people like I.F. Stone and journalists who wrote things fearlessly standing up on their own. I mean, so that, you know, people are having a hard time finding that now.
No, I agree with you. I think that's right on point. That people, it's amazing that a byproduct of the 60s movement, of course, was COINTELPRO, the plethora of media consolidation, and people do feel powerless now. I'm always amazed when I talk to young people that they'll say, you guys don't give us a chance to do our own thing. Well, see, in the 60s, when, Raff had problems with Dr. King, they said, and Ella Baker, look, we're going to form for nonviolent court. It's almost like young people now don't feel that sense of power. We actually believed in the 60s that we could change the world, and we did. The women's movement, the civil rights movement, the idea of ecology and the idea of to pay attention to the environment. We really believe we could make a difference. I don't think that a lot of young people, it's not a criticism, it's just an observation based on what you said. A lot of them don't feel as empowered as we do now because they also see consequences of retaliation that even in some cases we didn't see, even though we went through the assassination era, as I call it, in American politics. They see their stuff as being more at risk, and that it can be taken from them very, very quickly.
I agree with both you and with Mark that you feel powerless. I just want to just make one little amendment to that. I don't think it's just the young people. I think the people of my generation feel that there was a time when perhaps my parents had power, and I was kind of ushered into that power through privilege with my parents and what they worked for. But there's a sense of feeling powerless now, that you may have individual moments where you feel empowered. Something happened at your son's school and you stand up. Something happens in the grocery store. Somebody's racist. Like these little individual moments where you feel empowered. But can you actually change the world? I look at people who were involved in the movement, a little bit older than I am, who are now in academia. And I'm like, you are living a very different life than that person who marched out of the movement when you didn't, when you disagreed with something. Now you want to talk about it. Now we're arguing about commas and semicolons rather than kind of rising up to do something. So I don't think it's just the young people who don't feel empowered. I think there's a sense of powerlessness that seems to be pervasive throughout. And this is not just within the African American community. I wonder if it's just happening within the American society, that we feel that we have been completely disempowered, and those who rise up get struck down very, very quickly.
They do. And at the risk of sounding like a socialist, it's very much tied to capitalism.
Yes.
Right? It's tied to the...
Yeah. I'll say it for you.
It is tied to dollars. Mm-hmm. And there is a great risk at making those types of stances or statements in most of the venues that we operate in. And so the fear is all of that can be taken away. And I think that goes to show just where we are as a society, that we've bought into that whole notion of my power is linked to my money, my power is linked to my finances, and so if I don't have that, I then don't have any power, whether it's social or real.
Well, there are two things that popped in my head as you all were talking. I don't know which one to go to first. I'll come to the movement stuff second, I think, and what might actually be out there that we're not giving credit to, and how that fits into this legacy of Malcolm on a day like today. Mm-hmm. But let me start with something else, because something that Ray said, you said earlier about a leader. And let me go back to the election of Barack Obama. And one of the legacies, it seems to me, and this is almost, I think, is like the kind of a Jungian unconscious in the mass of people in our world that I'm talking about here, that Barack Obama, for many people when he first ran for president, embodied the untouchable, ephemeral parts of Malcolm and Martin and a dozen other people I could mention, embodied in this man, because he was the first black man to run for president seriously, is it, with a chance to win. And that all that kind of hope and dream mm-hmm. about a new America was put onto Barack Obama
by
black community,
everybody.
by a huge minority of white people as well. That to me, I kept thinking about Malcolm's legacy. Part of Malcolm's legacy and Martin's legacy was how people do want that change in this country,
yes.
And they saw it there, and many people were sorely disappointed what's happened in the last 8 years. People can debate that in many ways, from his opposition to whether he stood up strong enough and all the rest, which you don't have to get into today. But I'm just talking about the embodiment of Barack Obama was. Part of that was Malcolm.
Yes.
Part of that was the hope of the future, seen through the embodiment of a black man.
Yes.
He was the dream. He was the dream fulfilled.
He was.
The liberation.
And that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
That was a lot of pressure. There was no way he could have ever done anything correctly, because there were too many hopes and dreams placed upon his shoulders. I remember talking to people. I'm like, you know, despite what you might think, he actually doesn't walk on water. He can't raise the dead. He's not driving out demons. But when I speak to my grandmother, there was something there. When she talked about Barack Obama and his future, he is the one we have been waiting for. He's going to set everything right that's been wronged throughout history. That's a lot of pressure.
It's a lot of pressure, but let me throw something out that you all may push back, may agree, we'll see, but I'm going to throw it out there, that part of that embodiment of Malcolm in Barack Obama is that the liberation movement that grew out of the 50s and 60s in this country was a liberation movement that was, by and large, in many of its parts, led by black folk, and most of the figures were black men, but not all of them.
Right.
And so I think that people envisioning a new society in America envision it that way, unconsciously. It goes right alongside the kind of the roots of America being supremacist, which is clearly there. Not clearly there. It is there. But the other part of that is the embodiment of its liberation is seen through the face of somebody like Barack Obama or our visions of Malcolm and Martin in the past.
I can see that. I also thought it was very significant what you're saying. I want to see what Dr.
Moffitt's face. I can't see Ray's face, but I can imagine.
Kind of looking here, because I add to that, I was thinking about the excitement with the election of Ross Baraka. And for some people thinking that, here we have this change that we have been waiting for, all of this
and
happening.
And look at the numbers of white people in the audience from the unions that backed Ross
Baraka. So are we saying that we needed a biracial man to pull this off?
I'm a biracial man who looks black. I want to add that because that black face is important. Black.
I didn't say I didn't use the word biracial on purpose. I mean, I think.
Well, I guess that's where what I was hearing is that it needed to be someone like him, and so I took that to be that he was this blend of bringing America together.
No, I didn't see. I wasn't saying it that way. I was saying literally. Mm-mm. That the embodiment of liberation seen through the body and the visage of a black man.
Yes.
And that was part of what was going on at that moment because of the history.
People talk about...
That's what I'm saying.
I'm okay with that piece, though.
I am, too. I was just saying... Ray, why don't you jump in? What did you think, Ray?
Well... You guys put more faith in Barack than I did, so I'm going
to... Not in him.
But not in him. Not in him.
Well, see... You know, it's like a friend of mine said, we got to remember that he's, I'm not talking about Barack, but he's the president of the United States, and which means that he's going to be constrained no matter what color he is. Barack Obama, and I'm talking about Barack, but I'm not talking about Barack. I know that sounds paradoxical, but America would never elect a guy called Willie Jackson for president, that was black, you know, or somebody look like me or whatever. They just won't do it. Or somebody that would talk the truth. I think that this country saw on the surface, like what you were saying, Mark, he could have, you see, a black man as president of the United States. Just the thought makes you say, let's do that. But we also, I think, now have the bitter lesson that, you know, the American dream or the American plutocracy, oligarchy, whatever you want to call it, is firmly intact, and it's going to take more than just a person to change and to sway things. Let me just say this real quick. As most of you know, I'm a strong advocate for reparations. And we know in the United States, the black folk who are in the movement, that the push for reparations actually slowed down with the election of Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And it's partially because of the fact that we put our faith as, well, something's going to happen now, that the change is going to come. But the American system of whatever you want to call it, capitalism, white supremacy, whatever, is far more intractable than many of us ever thought it was going to be. And I think that's what's reflected in his presidency.
And there's no reason we should have expected after 200 plus years of operating in a particular way and a system that has benefited a particular group or racial group in this country that he could do something in 8 years to unravel and fix so much of that anyway.
Well, and I guess what I was pushing there, this idea, and I'm just thinking about the legacy of this moment, and I was thinking about Malcolm X, and I was thinking about a King's letter from the Birmingham jail, and I was thinking about a lot of things kind of focusing on this day of May the 19th for me and other revolutionary moments that happened on this day maybe it's a bit outrageous, but what I'm trying to push here with this is that thinking about Malcolm X on his birthday, what have you been, 89 today?
89.
Is that right?
89,
right?
Yep. 89.
That given the struggle in America, I just finished reading Grant Dean's book, and he was on the show the other day, The Empire of Necessity. Mm-hmm. We had him on last week.
Yeah.
Which is an incredible book.
Yes. Great book. Great book.
Incredible book. But every time I read these books and read this other book now, that another scholar's name I'm blocking on, who's an African-American scholar whose name I'm blocking on, who wrote the book on slavery and capitalism, it just came out that I'm getting ready to get into. The fact that slavery was the underpinning of capitalism, we wouldn't have Western capitalism if you didn't have slavery.
Right.
That's
right.
Just the nature of it.
It's being a slave nation.
That part of Grant's book was about that the liberation movement of the world was also tied to the enslavement of black people. You couldn't have liberation unless you had enslavement, both in terms of economic terms, but also it became part of the movement towards liberation was built out of slavery in some ways. Mm-hmm. That's another piece of it. That what has happened in this 21st century, and again, I don't mean the Barack Obama... You know, I'm not one of those people who is enamored of Barack Obama, what he's done or hasn't done. I have my own critique, and that's not important. But I was one of those people in Denver when I saw him up there speaking, tears were pouring out my eyes just to the fact that here was a black man about to go to the White House.
Right.
And I was like, what? This is actually happening?
Yeah.
So, but that was just emotional. That was visceral.
Hmm.
What I'm saying is I think that because of the nature of the struggle for liberation in America and slavery and racism and segregation and the remaining institutionalized racism and privilege and supremacy issues that the 21st century has to wrestle with, that the embodiment of that liberation coming out of Malcolm X is black in America for everybody, for white folks as well, who are thinking we need a different kind of world. And there's all kinds of stuff you can mix in that, and the racism is inside of that and all the other complexities inside of that. What I'm saying, that to me is the line for me between Malcolm and where we are today.
Which I definitely... Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Which I can agree with that. I'm not going to push back on that. I'm going to go with that. And I just want to add, there was one little point that you made where you said, you know, your response to Barack Obama, it was emotional. It was visceral.
Oh, completely emotional.
But I want to say that I think that was also very significant, that even though it was an emotional moment, a visceral moment, there was something very significant about the fact that given the history you just laid out that we're all familiar with, you know, the hundreds of years of enslavement in this country, the push to be free. You think about the breakdown of the Reconstruction era. You think about what happened, you know, pushing back against Jim Crow. You even think about the fact that it's the 19th, we just celebrated the 60th anniversary of Brown v. Board.
Brown v. Board.
I mean, you know, so we think about that. So we understand that moment of having a black man move out the point, you know, that he is biracial, because when you look at him, when we saw him on the stage, you saw a black man on his way to the highest seat in our nation. Even though it doesn't matter about his record for the last 8 years, which we can debate on another show, I'm talking about that moment and what it actually meant in terms of the struggles that we have come through. I know why my grandmother cried. I know why you cried, Mark. I know why I cried. Because even though we have not seen it play out in the last 8 years, the fact that that happened showed that we have come very far in a short period of time. Now, we have not gone as far as we need to go, but we definitely have come much farther than we were when we had black people enslaved and the small free black communities, or black people not being able to vote or having to get off the front of the bus and move to the back. We have come much farther. It's what Dr. Moffitt said earlier, that this idea of integration is something that we should really critique. I mean, that's what Thurgood Marshall said in the end. He said, if I knew what this meant, I probably wouldn't have pushed so hard for it, because integration meant that if you had black communities integrating into the white instead of black
building
and white
a new world.
Communities. Yeah. Integrating together.
That's right.
You know, we lost black businesses. We lost, you know, black schools went down. You know, HBCU still continue to suffer because of that. So I'm with Thurgood. If we had known what it was going to look like, we might have been talking about building a new world rather than just giving up everything within the black community to join the white community and never still be equal. Is that what Malcolm X says? See, people start a race, and if one person has a weight on their leg and one person is completely unfettered, we're never going to catch up.
That's right.
Because the weight is always going to hold us back. Yeah.
I think another, you know, what you were saying, Mark, that, you know, it's the paradox, and I think history will show this, that is that the spirit of wanting to change that we thought was going to be in Barack Obama, I think, I think that he never took advantage of that. I think this country wanted that change. It wanted it at several levels with regard to women, with regards to black folk, with regards to the way we do business as a government in general. The country as a whole have asked him to do that for two elections in a row. And for some reason, he's unable to see that. And I know that's a specific critique of Barack Obama, but, you know, the issue is whether or not we're ever going to get the change that he talked so much about in these past couple of elections.
As long as it's politicians at the table, no.
Yeah, that's true. And we must remember that he's a politician.
Yes,
a civil rights leader.
Yes,
I know exactly. Yes. And I think your comment earlier, Kimberly, about integration that Kay was picking up on as well, and that Ray has talked about a lot on this here in your past. Is real, because I think that part of the problem I have to wrestle with now, part of the problem of the 21st century, one of those problems is going to be integrate into what?
Yeah.
And what does integration mean, right?
Burning house.
And what do I give up?
We say, Ray, a burning house.
That's what Dr. King, or was it Malcolm? One of them said, do we really want to be integrated into a burning house? Right. I forget which one said it, but it's true. It's a good point. It really is.
There's a piece, I'm just going to read you real fast, that I was looking for different things about Malcolm, and This guy wrote from a Muslim perspective about Malcolm from Britain. He said, many Muslims revere Malcolm X not only for what he shares with other revolutionary figures, but also for his special legacy. Like others, Malcolm dedicated himself to the pursuit of justice. He was always in a path of self-enrichment, and he did his best to live up to Islamic ideals. But he made mistakes, too, and his many imperfections have made him all the more relatable to Muslims everywhere, especially the younger generation. Malcolm's humility, his willingness to admit his shortcomings if it led him to the truth, is arguably one of the most important lessons we, Muslims and non-Muslims alike, take from his life, can draw from his life. I found that kind of very profound in a lot of ways.
Yeah. You know, it's ironic that somebody told me, I never thought about this, but the three most recognizable men on this planet, or people on this planet, and they, I forget what era they were talking about, but they talk about Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, Barack Obama, Malcolm X, and Dr. King in terms of just, oh, and Muhammad Ali. That was, he was in there too. And it's ironic that Malcolm holds such sway. I've been in Muslim countries, and I'm talking about Orthodox Muslim countries, and they'll still say, well, you know, Malcolm didn't adhere totally towards Islam, but he is still one of the greatest leaders. So even they recognize him as such. Ironic. What a legacy.
Yeah. And let's not forget the Twin Cities has started Malcolm X Day. And
Twin Cities?
Yes.
Minnesota?
Minnesota.
Minnesota.
That's shocking.
Minnesota.
Okay. I think it's a legacy that we need to really...
Call that a black city.
Yeah, we have to make sure that we're teaching it. Yeah. I'm not agreeing with you. I'm agreeing with you. I just think that it's a legacy that we have to make sure that we are teaching, and a legacy we have to make sure that we're guarding. It's something that Dr. Wimbush said in the beginning. You know, you bring Martin down to I Have a Dream, and you try to bring Malcolm down to, you know, by any means necessary, that when you're limiting the history and the legacy of these leaders, I think you're shortchanging everybody. Nobody benefits if all we think about Malcolm is by any means necessary, holding the weapon at the window. If you think about that out of context, then you never can understand things that he talked about in terms of patriotism and the way he challenged religion in terms of freedom and the way he said the wrong is wrong. That, you know, we're talking about you don't have to be an activist to make change. You just have to be a human being is what he said. That if you just boil him down to that, then you forget about all the other things. You forget the nuances or how he grew. You think about Malcolm Little and, you know, Malcolm X and El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. Like, you forget about the fact that he was human. I think that we do that with King as well. If it's just I Have a Dream, then you never think about how he challenged the government, how he challenged capitalism, and how he worked for the Poor People's Campaign. Like, you forget that. You think of him just kind of this big Santa Claus who loved everybody and were willing to give up everything to be a part of that. And I think that is the problem. One of the things I tell my students that what I like about Mandela is the fact that not only did he have a long life, but we were able to see Mandela change and grow and evolve. And we were able to see how he became more human every year, that with King and with X, who were struck down in the prime of their life, they stopped at their moment. So all we have is the legacy we have built around them, rather than what could have happened, the possibilities of the type of men they would have become as children begin to age and grandchildren begin to come up, or when they recognize that maybe I can't change the world, and maybe I can only change my little piece of the world.
But I think it's, I think that's a valid point. And it's also important, though, that Malcolm X is still a part of that conversation, because I do agree when we think about K-12 education that he is being left out of that conversation. And so even the whittling down him to the four words of by any means necessary, a lot of children don't know that piece. And so it's important for us to still make him a part of the conversation so that our children do understand that we had, even in the civil rights movement, this complexity and this diversity of perspectives that were coming out of the civil rights movement from multiple voices and not just one.
And Ray, I'm thinking about, like, you just throw your thoughts in what you just heard the other two participants just say. I think in the last few minutes we have left here, because I think that, you know, there is a, I do see a ferment in this country bubbling up from the bottom in communities across America. I see it here in Baltimore in the Economic Democracy Conference they had over the weekend here in Baltimore, and other things that are going on that have brought together, you know, activists all across the city, black and white, from Sojourner Douglas, from neighborhoods, just to mm-hmm. wrestle with how to build something new. I think that's happening everywhere. So I think in some ways that is the legacy of Malcolm X, and that he embodies for many the revolutionary spirit of change that I think many people, Ray, don't want to give up on.
You're right, and I think there, in a very paradoxical sense, maybe all of what Malcolm stood for was that, you know, the revolutionary spirit, the spirit of change, is out there now. And I think that, you know, maybe the task of this generation is how do you harness it and focus it towards some of the things that really do need to be changed. I'm giving a speech in Dallas on Monday about Malcolm, and they asked me to say, what would Malcolm do? Mm-hmm. And I talked to my sponsor just this morning, and they said, well, we want you to talk about what he would do with Boko Haram. Well, I don't know. But I think
he wouldn't be happy with it, I'm sure. But.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, Malcolm probably would say, I don't know either. And I think we've got to be willing to say that. But I think that the sense that we've got to do something mm-hmm. is something that Malcolm left with us. A lot of people before the 60s, I'm not saying no one, but a lot of people didn't even ask the question, what can we do about this? They had accepted it. Mm-hmm. And Malcolm taught us not to accept it. Dr. King taught us not to accept mm-hmm. it, as did Fannie Lou Hamer and others. And I think that spirit is like, now that we know that we aren't going to take it anymore, how do we deal with it? And how do we harness that energy?
I think for me, if I think very quickly about the legacy of what would Malcolm do, I think about the fact that he did not allow his past to stop him from succeeding.
Absolutely.
That you could come from anything. You can come from prison. Well, yeah. You can come from being a pimp. You can come from being a drug dealer and then move up and lead your people in a new direction.
And it goes deeper than that. When you said that, it made me think of, we have to end here, made me think of when people talk about education in the world today and when kids can't succeed. Yeah. I don't believe that.
That's right. No.
Because I would say, when people say, if you didn't have X amount of words by X amount of time, then you'll but you'll never be able to succeed. I always say, think about slavery.
Yes.
Think of people who walked out of slavery not knowing how to read and write and learned Greek and Latin and higher mathematics and wrote books.
Right.
Don't tell me somebody can't learn because they don't have X amount of words by the time they reach the first grade. I don't believe it.
That's
so,
excellent.
So I want to thank all of you for being here. Dr. Ravenbush, thank you so much for being with us once again, Director of the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University. Always good to have you with us, my friend.
Thank you, Matt.
And Dr. Kay Whitehead, Assistant Professor of Communications in African and African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland, who wrote this new book we're going to talk about soon, Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis. Good to see you.
Thank you so much,
Can't wait to read the book.
Excellent.
And Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Assistant Professor of American Studies at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC, author of Black Berries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Have a great Malcolm X Day, and stay tuned. We're going to come back with a conversation with the woman who broke the story of the media files, of FBI files in Meany, Pennsylvania, sent to the Washington Post that told the secrets of what happened with the FBI. Coming up next, stay with us. On our way to break, you're hearing Jimmy Lyons Quintet playing Methods. Jimmy Lyons died on this day in 1986, just 1 year to the date after recording this song. We'll be right back.